Hello, welcome along to a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. Thank you so much for coming along to try and spot some of the secrets lurking out there in space. This week, we're learning about one of the most terrifying places in the world. Also, I've got a lot of moon news for you later. Stuff that's happening around the moon and stuff that's happening on the moon as well. I've said moon so many times I've confused myself about the word moon. Also, I've got some of your questions. Today, they're about atoms, tears and radiation. First, let's get a brand new series on the show. We're headed to Deep Space High, where this time round, Professor Pulsar is explaining why space is for everyone.
Deep Space High, space for all.
Jump into your wormhole and travel to Deep Space High, the school in space. But hurry, because lessons are about to begin.
Down, you lot. This term, I want to talk to you about what jobs you might want to do when you're a bit older and what you might have to study to get there. Right, who's first? Sam, what's your dream job?
That's the trouble. I haven't got a clue.
Well, we know that.
I mean, I love being here and a job in space sounds amazing, but I just don't think I'm cut out to be, well, a rocket scientist.
Rocket scientists and astronauts aren't the only people working in space exploration. Whatever your interests are, there's a job in space for you. Who here's got a hobby? Anyone want to kick things off?
Quark loves kicking off. His favourite lesson is sport. I guess he might have to come down to Earth for his dream job. It's quite hard to play football in zero gravity, even with six legs.
And that's where you're wrong. Whatever subject you love, whatever your interests and hobbies might be, there's a career for you in space.
But football? Really?
Yes, really. Sport and fitness experts are a crucial part of space travel and living in space. Come on, I'll show you. Computer, swimming pool, simulation.
With no gravity in space, you need to get used to the feeling of being nearly weightless. And where better than in water? For many years, astronauts have trained in special pools called neutral buoyancy pools, practicing everything from spacewalks to making snacks. Have a try just walking about. Go on.
It's quite hard to move around underwater. Nothing quite goes where you want it to. It must take them ages to get anything done. This is knackering.
It does take some getting used to. Seeing as how I'm in a good mood, I'll zap us all onto dry land. End simulation.
People called sports scientists and fitness experts design training programs and make sure that anyone going into space are in the best condition before liftoff and continue to stay fit when in space.
But how can you exercise when there's no gravity? The balls would just disappear into space.
Computer, zero-G simulation, fitness suite.
Well, this is weird. This treadmill has straps to hold me down. It's very tiring.
Looks like Quark would do better in zero-G than you, Sam. That's because he's fitter by the look of it.
He's got six legs.
Fair point. Okay, treadmill's off, everyone.
But haven't astronauts got more important things to do than work out?
Our bodies aren't built for space. They're built for a planet a lot like our Earth. Bones, heart, lungs, muscles, they all change in weightlessness. They all become weaker as they no longer have to work against gravity. And the longer you stay in space, the more noticeable the changes will be. Especially when you're back on good old terra firma.
That doesn't sound good.
Don't worry. Sports scientists are experts in knowing how bodies change as gravity changes. They design and monitor astronauts' training every step of the way. And they use tethered treadmills and cycling machines to help keep muscles in good condition. So, Quark, you can see, sport and fitness fans like you are a vital member of the space team. Next time, I'll be asking some more of you about your hobbies and interests. It's not impossible that they'll give you some ideas about other jobs in space, Sam. Although it seems impossible to get you lot to leave a room quietly.
Deep Space High, space for all. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
Right, let's get some of your questions answered on the show. If you've got something sciencey that you can't figure out, let me try and work it out for you. Just leave your question as a review over on Apple Podcasts. That's what Kirsten has done. Hello, Kirsten. You ask, how do we know what electrons and neutrons are? It's a brilliant question. And here's the problem with trying to figure that out. You see, we see things because of how objects, particles, reflect and deflect light. But atoms, they're so small that they're pretty much invisible to light. So, how do we know what's inside an atom? Well, the physicist J.J. Thomson, in 1897, he used a pretty amazing way to find this out, to prove that atoms and electrons existed. And it was all because of what they did to other things. Get your head around this. He made something called a Crookes tube, which was a strange-shaped, kind of conical, kind of cylindrical glass. And almost all the air was sucked out of it, so it was almost a vacuum. Then a negative electrical charge was applied to one end of the tube. Now, because of this, it ripped out all the electrons from the glass that were still in there. They whizzed out, and because these electrons are negatively charged as well, they flew down the tube, they moved at 37,000 miles a second, and they smashed into the end of this tube. Now, the crash made so much energy, it created a greeny, yellowy glow, and that's how they figured out that these electrons must exist. It's quite tough to get your head around, isn't it? It's a huge concept. That's just the start of it. Maybe we'll get a proper expert on to explain that in more detail in the next few weeks or so. Next up, thank you for that, Kirsten. Next up is from Lupa, who is in London, who asks, how are tears made when we cry? Now, I think we spoke about this a little earlier on in the year, Lupa. If you missed it, here's the answer. Now, tears are made in the lacrimal glands of your eyes. And you're crying all the time. All the time. But tinily. Now, you weep something called basal tears, which keeps the dirt away quite a lot. I mean, you go through 200 millilitres of tears every single day. Now, scientists aren't exactly sure why we cry when we're sad. They think maybe it's evolutionary. You cry when you're sad to get sympathy from other people, perhaps. You used to do that when you were cave people. But they do know that the lacrimal gland that makes these tears is partially controlled by a part of your brain called the limbic system, and that deals with emotions. Maybe that's why you cry when you're happy as well. Scientists have also found that tears contain hormones which act as a painkiller and calm you down. So there's a lot of reasons why we cry. No one's really too sure of it just yet, but thank you for the question, Lupa. And lastly, hello to Olivia, who is 10 years old, who says, congrats on getting the best podcast in the universe award. Thank you for sending that, Olivia. It reminds me, probably need to start getting my entry together for next year. Takes a while to send a file over the internet to a planet millions of light years away. Need to get that edited shortly. Anyway, thank you for that. Also, your question is, what is radiation? Well, radiation is when energy is transferred through waves, like electromagnetic radiation. These waves, I mean, the energy can be transferred through heat waves or sound waves or light waves, and it can be good or it can be bad. It can be good when we use high energy gamma rays to kill cancerous cells in a body. But also it's bad because if we're exposed to too much radiation, it can change the way your cells are made and behaved. It can damage them, and that's what can make you ill. There's a lot going on in radiation, Olivia. Thank you for the question that got us started with it. If you want something answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly now. Comedian and space expert Dara O'Brien, he's got a new book out and he's on Zoom with us right now. Dara, how are you?
I'm very well, really, really well. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the new book is called Is There Anybody Out There?
Yes.
I'm going to run through the blurb very quickly. It says, is there anybody out there? No. Well, maybe. Do aliens exist? Probably. Possibly. So I need to start there, Dara. Do aliens exist?
Well, we don't know. That's the thing. It's a massive question. It's one where obviously everyone is interested in, but we don't have any proof that they do yet. And so the book starts with basically, well what do we do? You know, how do we find out? What are we looking for? What form might they take? And when it comes to if we eventually meet them, could we even talk to them? So there's a lot of questions when we're in the state of wondering at this stage. And, you know, because the chances are there are lots and lots of planets. So there's a good chance there's something out there. But also, they're a long way away. So there's a lot of big numbers and small numbers involved. And we don't know where it's going to come out, to be honest.
It always strikes me, the one thing that always confuses me is when they say life as we know it.
Yes.
And you always think, well, surely these are aliens by the very definition of being alien. It might not be life as we know it. Can you build on that a bit for us? What is life?
Well, there is. I mean, we're just one example of how life would develop, you know, because our lovely planet Earth is perfect for a certain type of life. And we can draw some lessons from that, you know, about, you know, will they hear, will they see, or that kind of stuff like that. But our candidates nearby for life, it'll be very, very different. And only last week they said we might have discovered life on Venus, and it would be a microbe floating in clouds that lives its entire life floating in clouds way above the planet's surface. We're not going to be sitting down having cups of tea with them. And the fact, really, our solar system isn't going to, we're not going to find Chewbacca in our solar system. We're not going to find Yoda, anything like that. They're all going to be somewhere. Groot is not going to be in our 8 planets, sadly. They're going to be more likely somewhere far, far away. And even then, if we meet them, I mean, we have tremendous difficulty anyway talking to the alien life that we have around us. I mean, I have a section in the book about how far, or not how far we've got with dolphins or apes or octopuses or any of those other intelligent life forms that we have on Earth that, frankly, we again don't sit down having cups of tea with. So yeah, when we meet a foreign life, it could be very foreign. We could just be staring at each other.
Let me build on that, what you just said. Are there active attempts for us to try and talk to dolphins, to gorillas, to all these things?
Oh, very much so. There's a really cool scientist, oh, I don't have her name, I forgot the book I have it, who has spent the last few years basically living in the Caribbean, which is a good gig to get in science, but underwater with a kind of they've got a push, like a breastplate push button thing that you could, that the dolphins can communicate and ask for certain toys, or they can have rudimentary conversations with them. And they're hoping to do one that they can work as a kind of a universal translator so that they can talk to the dolphins in the language of clicks that the dolphins use, and the dolphins can then press symbols for what they want to say. Now, the only thing is, that's very rudimentary. It's very, I would like to play with the hoop rather than play with the ball, not I'm not feeling great today, how are you? That's a more difficult conversation to get across to them. So, but they're there and we are trying to communicate, but that's really, really slow. I mean, it'd be very frustrating if we go to another planet, we finally meet another life form, and we realize we have nothing to say to them.
I'd never thought about that. It never entered my mind that of course we're not going to be able to communicate that easily with the aliens. We can't speak to the other creatures that are here on this planet that easily.
Look, the other thing is, it also depends on the environment that they're living in. If they live in an environment which is, let's say, opaque, right, thick clouds the entire way through, then they're not going to be looking for things. That's not the way they'll be. Their eyes would operate like our eyes operate, because they won't be able to. So they will work on electro-sensing, like some animals already do here, or they'll work on some other sense form that we don't use. So they literally could be walking into these things without knowing where they are and trying to work out how to communicate with them at the same time. So yeah, look, one of our candidates for this, there's two moons, one called Enceladus, and what's the other one? There is the Enceladus and the other moon of Jupiter, which is Europa. Now, they both have the same kind of structure, which is there's an ocean of water and then there's an icy shell around them. We think they're both possible candidates for some sort of probably microbial little thing life, right? But if there's any bigger than that, you're literally talking about an animal that doesn't know up from down in the way we do, and probably thinks that the top is the bottom and the bottom is the top, and has never seen beyond the ice, the 100 mile thick ice that surrounds its water. So we would literally be going there, knocking on the glass and getting it to turn around for the first time and have a look at us. I mean, they've lived in totally different environments.
It's still amazing how, even though it might be so tiny, they might not know who we are, that's still really exciting. Finding these creatures out there is amazing.
It would be, and like I don't say this in the book, but I have a sneaking suspicion what we'll find out is our solar system is a lot dirtier, a lot grubbier, a lot more fingerprints all over our solar system than we thought. We'll probably find small forms of life used to be on Mars, are on Venus, and maybe it might be on some of the moons around Jupiter and Saturn. So actually, it'll be a bit like jam that, you know, that people have left behind. We don't know where it'll have come from, but it'll be splodges of it in loads of different places, and we're the only place that currently it's really bedded in life, but that it's, you know, it's popped up in other places, but we're just waiting for those final bits of proof.
Now, that the title and that question, is there on anybody out there, it comes from the book is made of different questions, isn't it? It's made of different thoughts about science. Dara, can you just run us through a few more to give us a taster of the book, stuff that kids want to know?
because we don't know, I would love if chapter three was me introducing you to, and look, this is Derek, right? This Derek lives on this planet. But instead it becomes kind of an interesting question of there are other planets. We need other planets, right? So have we found any other planets? And amazing, we found lots of other planets. So a large of it is about a thing called exoplanets, which is a very recent thing that we've decided to, we've worked out how it is that we can look at distant stars and see little wobbles in the star, which mean can only happen because they've got a planet orbiting them. And then, or we can see the way the life from a star dips just a tiny amount. And that little dip means that there's a planet going in front. If it dips again a certain amount of time later and then dips the same amount again, then this thing is orbiting around. So there's a planet there. Right? So we found all these really amazing techniques of finding planets. So we spent 200 years finding three planets, one of whom we then stopped calling a planet. So we found Uranus, Neptune, and then Pluto. And that's all we found for about 300 years. And then in the last 10 years, we found 4,000 of them. So it's a really big growth field. Finding planets is a big thing now.
What's changed in the last 10 years? Is it simply technology? Are we much better at knowing what we're looking for now?
Absolutely. And we're in the ability now that we can send up a particular kind of like the Hubble telescope. We've got telescopes that we send up and we sit them outside of our atmosphere, long way away, in fact, thousands of miles away from atmosphere, just looking at a little patch of sky and just looking for little dips of light in the stars. And it does this all the time. And because of that, we've spotted 4,000 and more. We're all ready to process more with the, who knows what's in the bank waiting to be found out. But we spot these things, spot these little patterns. And then from that we know, and that's only happened in the last 10 years.
It's a shame, isn't it, that you're not introducing us to Derek in chapter three.
It was so good.
What a boon for the sales. Can you imagine that?
Me with standing next to Derek, and we're both giving big thumbs up, going, yes, there is somebody out there. It's Derek. But poor Derek, no, he's quite lonely because he'd be the only one.
Yeah, he'd have a good life story as well. That would be the next book published. It's Derek, why always me?
Something yes, like yeah, Derek, any stories from being an alien? What has happened instead is that we've actually sent life out, as we know, we've sent human life out, but we've even sent other life out. We've sent, you know, we worry all the time that we're going to send probes out somewhere accidentally and actually start popping lives up by just being messy and dirty. But there is, on the moon, we have put 96 bags of poo that we left behind when we were up there with the astronauts. And the poo had to go somewhere, so they left behind in bags on the moon. And we don't think it's still there. We don't think it survived the 50 years. But for a while there were definitely bacteria from us on the moon. And then we crashed a spaceship into the moon, I think it was about 6-7 years ago, and on it were things called tardigrades. And tardigrades are these tiny little microscopic animals, like water bears they're called. And we know they can survive in space. We've literally put them up on a probe that went up and came back down, up to the atmosphere and came back down again, and went into the proper vacuum, cold of space. And they survived that. You have to take some time to revive them, but they will survive that. And we crashed them accidentally onto the moon. So we crashed it on an Israeli mission that had a tiny version of all the world's books printed onto some sort of microfilm as a kind of a library on the moon. And we sent the tiny library and tiny animals up to the moon, and they crashed there, and we think they're still there.
And you know, don't you, that it's got all the makings of a Doctor Who plot, that by the time we finally meet these aliens, they'll be the tardigrades that we left there that just slightly evolved.
Yeah, but also we get them all of our books, so they know everything we know.
Yeah, and they managed to type Shakespeare in about 5 minutes.
Listen,
you mentioned poo in space. So I get sent so many questions as a review for the podcast over on Apple Podcasts. If you're listening, that's where you need to go. And I thought I would throw you some of these questions, if that's cool. Right, Dara, just to test you. So this is from Ryan, who is 6, who asks, when astronauts go to the loo in space on the space station, ISS, where does the waste go?
Oh, that's very good. Normally they gather all this stuff up and they swap over when they send up, they send up missions to resupply. So they got to send up, you know, fruit and water and all these things, whatever. And they send things up to them semi-regularly with stuff. So, and then what they do is they'll get the waste and they'll hand it back, and that'll be brought back down again. There was, and I haven't had this confirmed, an idea that they would just push it out. Like they would push the waste thing out and let it burn up in the atmosphere. That was a thing. And I'm not totally sure they do this, but I love it. Because I think the implications are if you push it away, you actually push back. So it probably wouldn't be a good thing. But the idea that, because if you push it down to it falls to Earth, right? And they would burn up in the atmosphere like a shooting star. So astronaut poo would be one of the, like, somebody would be sitting out and like, oh my God, look at that. Let's make a wish. It's a shooting star. No, it's burning poo. It's giant burning poo burning through the atmosphere.
Right. This one's from William, another space one. We're going right to the end of space now. When, I'm going to say this is distance rather than time. When does the universe end?
Oh, we don't know. What we know the end of is the end of the observable universe, which is a big word, basically meaning that it's taken a while for light to get to us. We know the universe is about 13.8 billion years old. We know roughly when the Big Bang was. So we know what all we can see is the light that's taken that time to get to us. So there's a kind of a visible limit to it, but we don't know what's beyond that. It could like stop 10 meters beyond that. There could be a wall. Or more likely it goes on and on and on and on and on for some considerable, possibly always distance. But we don't know what's beyond the bit we can see.
Because all we can see is this, isn't it? It's expanding like a balloon. That's what it was once described.
It is. The space itself is expanding. So all we're getting is, all we can see is stuff that has been around long enough for the light to get to us.
Yeah.
That's the scale. It's sort of... Look, this will wreck your head. This is the kind of thing that is very difficult to get your head around, like whatever. But the only limit we know to it all is the limit of how far we can see.
Yeah. And what's that right at the end? Oh, it's a tardigrade.
Yeah, just at the end, it's a tardigrade riding a horse, running off just directly in front of the light.
Last one. This isn't space, but I've never been able to get my head around this brilliantly. I wondered if you could help. It's fine if you can't. Harry is 9, who asks, is electricity a living thing? And how does it work?
Oh, look, it's like a fish that lives in your wall. And what you do is when you plug your something in, the fish sees that and recycles a tiny bicycle. And the tiny bicycle makes what you've plugged into the wall work. That's as good an explanation as you're going to get, because it is genuinely astonishing, actually. It is the tiniest of things, electrons moving along pipes. And they're each of them tiny, but lots and lots of them somehow make a washing machine work. Yeah. And the finest minds of all of your parents don't really understand that.
They all pretend they do.
But if you ask them three questions, why? No. Better. Explain more. Why does it not all roll out of the wall when you take the plug out? Why is it we don't have to stopper it up like whatever? It's kind of weird. It is just the tiniest electrons just belting along because they want to get to the bit. There's a lot of them at one end and there's none at the other, and they want to get from the bit where there's lots of them to the bit where there's none. They want to balance that off. Like water, like a waterfall to a certain extent. It wants to rush to where it all goes flat and it's all kind of still. But the power of just those little things moving is enough to do big work. Like the way to look at it is, if you get a battery, I'm very fond of this example. If you get a battery, people always think, oh, it's really sad. I've got a battery, but I've used it up and now I'm going to take the battery out and throw it in the recycling. Okay. So that's the end of that battery, right? But actually when the battery started, all the electrons were in one side of the battery and they really wanted to go to the other side of the battery. And it was only when you plugged it into something that suddenly they had a path to walk around from one side of the battery and get to where they wanted to go. So when you get to a dead battery, it's very happy. It's done all the things it wants to do. All the electrons have gone where they want to go.
They've had a nice moment. That's fun. Well, I tell you what, Harry, I have had so many conversations with my dad about voltage. I've never got my head around voltage at all. Dara has done a better job than I think you're ever going to get. But thank you very much for the question.
A pleasure. Voltage is the height of the waterfall, as far as I remember. So that's
it's how long they need to walk to get to the party at the other end of the battery. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Brilliant. Well, the new book is there on anybody out there? Dara, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for coming on.
A pleasure.
Now for this week's Dangerous Dan, we're headed to North Australia, to the eastern edge of the Kakadu National Park, to an extremely deadly place called Cahill's Crossing. Now, it stretches across the East Alligator River. And inside the river, not alligators, it's famous for its crocodile-infested waters. Now, the road itself that stretches across the river is quite low. On either side of it are crocodiles all around. Rangers have conducted a test of it and have found 120 crocodiles in just a 6 kilometre stretch of the water. Sometimes 40 crocs can be there at a time, floating alongside each other in the river. And you can drive on this road. Experts say that for every croc you see, there are 10 hidden in the water nearby. Now, this would be fine, I guess, if the road was safe. If it had edges. That's where the problem lies. It's low. It's got nothing to stop you driving off the edge. And when the river level gets a bit higher, it's been known to sweep cars off the road straight into the water. Crocodiles also leap onto the road, waddling along, waiting for someone silly enough to try and walk along the river, which turns out happens. Every year, fishermen and backpackers, they walk along the river to come face to face with the crocs. Have a look at a picture of this online if you get the chance. It's utterly terrifying. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world. Now we're headed to another pretty dangerous place. To go there, we need to travel back in time. This is the Age of the Dinosaurs.
Age of the Dinosaur with Dinosaur Action Magazine, the number one mag for dino fans.
Welcome to the end of the Jurassic period, 145 million years ago. As the Jurassic period came to a close and the Cretaceous period began, many new types of animal and plant life were evolving, and a new kind of creature was starting to take to the skies. Birds.
Watch out, something is swooping at us.
Wow, it's an Archaeopteryx, the first known bird. Only 10 fossils of the Archaeopteryx have been found, but they're important because they prove that birds evolved from dinosaurs. However, they were very different to birds we know today. The Archaeopteryx was the size of a crow. Whilst they had feathers, they also had teeth, claws on their wings, and long tails. They also weren't great flyers, more likely to glide for short distances rather than flap about.
He hasn't seen us. He's perched up in the tree.
Being able to hide in trees is a great way to stay safe. It's believed that small dinosaurs evolved into bird-like creatures either to help them escape from predators, more powerful dinosaurs who preyed on smaller and lighter creatures, or to help them go after prey that lived up in trees, such as insects and small lizards. To survive over thousands of years, these small dinosaurs evolved. They grew long but light feathers, and their front legs got longer to form wings that would help them fly. Other dinosaurs grew feathers, but as they stayed too large, and as their arms weren't strong enough, they never flew. One such dinosaur was the Dilong, which was the same size as a dog. Although he couldn't fly, his feathers would have helped him keep warm, and might have allowed him to show off to other Dilongs when competing over territory or mates.
Quick! That's not a bird. It's a flying reptile. Let's get out of here.
I think we're safe here. Along with the early birds, pterosaurs ruled the sky. Pterosaurs didn't have feathers. They were flying reptiles with strong arm muscles and wings made of thin skin. But don't worry, that's a Ramphorhynchus. He's mostly interested in sea life. He flies low over the lagoons and uses his pointed beak to grab at fish and other small creatures.
Paleontology. Pick.
When all that's left behind are fossils, it's hard to say what colour dinosaur skin or Archaeopteryx feathers were. Recently, scientists have discovered small parts of pigment cells called melanosomes. Through the use of clever technology and comparing results to today's animals and birds, they can make some amazing discoveries. For example, they now know that the Cynoceropteryx, a small bird-like dinosaur, had dark-coloured stripes along its tail and an orange-coloured crest along its back.
Age of the Dinosaur with Dinosaur Action Magazine, the number one mag for dino fans.
Let's get this week's Science in the News. NASA has revealed evidence of water on the moon. This boosts their hopes of making a base there, as they can use the moon's natural resources to keep astronauts going while they're on the lunar surface. Also staying in space, Thales Alenia Space in Italy, TSA, they will make Europe's two big contributions for the US-led space station around the moon, Lunar Gateway. They'll build two sections, one where astronauts can live, the other where equipment can stay. The gateway is made to stay near the moon, so astronauts can go there on their way back and forth from the Earth to the lunar surface, kind of like a halfway house between the Earth and the moon. And finally, the Scottish government is hoping to power 8 million homes by wind in 2030. It'll hope to make wind farms out in sea, where it hopes to get 11 gigawatts of power from the air. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review for us over on Apple Podcasts. While you're there, you can find some of the other brilliant science series that we do. They're all free for you to listen to. You can get them on Apple, Spotify, wherever else you get your shows from. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids are a children's radio station from the UK. You can listen to us all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that Fun Kids app, and as always at funkidslive.com.